If I pick something from 1 Corinthians 9, some of you may have heard on occasion me share a few thoughts on this before. If you remember, first place, if you don't remember, you ought to hear it again. And if you do remember, it's been so long ago, it must have been a pretty good message. It won't hurt to hear it again. So having excused myself there, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 9, verses 24 to 27. And the title is How a Small Group Can Make a Big Impact. In the Navigators, we are a minority within a minority within a minority. Christianity is a minority religion. Evangelicals are a minority within it, and we are certainly a tiny little minority within the evangelical group. We're just a dinky little outfit, really. Could you believe that 15 years ago people thought the Navigators was getting too big? And 10 years ago people come up to me and say, you know, do you think the Navigators is getting too big? I said, how big is big? Depends on what you're looking at and what you're comparing it to. We've got a pretty good sized world. And I meet a few people here and there that never heard of the Navigators. Do you ever meet anybody that never heard of the Navigators? Huh. You meet very many who have. We're a little outfit, a little group. And by God's grace, we'll get much bigger. But how can a small group like ours make a big impact? Well, we'll lift out some thoughts here from 1 Corinthians 9, 24 through 27. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners compete? But only one receives the prize. So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. Now they do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Well, I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. For a small group to make a big impact, I picked out five things from this paragraph. And the first is that you must have a worthwhile prize. A worthy goal. Something worth fighting for. Something worth going after. Something you feel is worthy of the investment of your life, of your time, of your money. Do you not know that in a race all the runners compete, but only one receives the prize? What would you think to be a worthwhile prize? Well, I'm sure that already 99 and 99 one-hundredth percent of us know what that prize is as far as we're concerned. It's men, women, it's people. When Jesus challenged the disciples, with the idea of following him, he held out before them what promise? I will make you fishers of men. That was the prize. That will be worthwhile following me. When they'd been out fishing all night and taken nothing, and the Lord said, look, put the net on the other side of the net, and they got this huge catch of fish. And old Peter came and said, depart from me, for I am a sinful man. And Jesus said, don't be afraid. Henceforth you will catch men. You'll catch men. And he did. He caught him in a big net, too, day of Pentecost. Paul said, what is our joy or crown of rejoicing? Are not even you, Thessalonian Christians, in the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ at his coming? Rob pointed out last night that it's worthwhile, according to Isaiah 43:4, to exchange your life for people. We, most of us, heard the story of Ray Ho when he was getting applied for a job with the banana company on the banana boat, and how the fellow leaned across the desk to him and said, young man, I want you to get this clear. We are looking for men in our company who are willing to give their lives for bananas. Now, I don't have anything against bananas myself. I like bananas. I like bananas every which way. I like them on peanut butter and a little honey and some bananas on top. I like them on cereal. I like them on ice cream. I like bananas. But I don't want to give my life for bananas. Do you know of anything more perishable than bananas? Anything more risky than being a banana? When a banana leaves a bunch, it gets skinned. Terrible. Now, a worthy prize is people, right? Men and women. Take the people who live in your home or who have lived with you. Remember the heartaches? Remember the struggles? Remember the irritations? I remember one home in which there was a girl staying there, supposed to be helping, and they were at swords points. That thing was at the roof was about literally to blow off the house. And they called from some help on my side to come in and help settle this and get the thing sort of straightened around and get the temperature down, even if you couldn't put the fire out. And so they worked at it. A couple years later, I went to a wedding of this young lady. And who had she asked to give her away in the absence of her father, the man of the home? Who was the maid of honor? The lady of the home. You know how it is. Sometimes you lay down your life, you open up your family circle and all the rest, and now you look back and they're just like brother and sister to you, aren't they? And any way they go, forever, the rest of your life, there's a tie to those people. That's just, it's even deeper than a blood tie. You know what I mean. You've exchanged something of yourself for people. And it's worthwhile. It's worth it. Now, the navigators, as we know, our objective is men. Interestingly enough, I've been in this outfit for quite a bit of time. I spent quite a bit of time on the objective. And you know, one thing that we never can agree on is to how to say it. The navigator objective. But I can also tell you something else. I have tried various ways from time to time to test some of our people to see if I could push them off the nav objective and the sparks flew. There is something that's down deep in the hearts of the navigator staff and have been through the years that you can't budge them. And there have been four basic ingredients to the navigator objective all since the year one that have not changed regardless of how we've communicated or tried to say it. Number one is the Great Commission. And when I speak of the Great Commission, it's in two parts, winning the lost and building up the saved. Number two has to do with men, laborers, producers, reproducers, whatever you want to call them, men. Three, there's always been the idea of multiplication. That's however you say it, however you communicate it, there is at the heart of this idea, the idea of multiplying the people. It's always been there. And the fourth is the world, that we have a responsibility and a commitment to and an aim for that we might do something significant in every country, the whole world. Now, how do you say that? I don't know. I suppose it depends on who you're talking to. A year and a half ago, I went to an American Management Association conference back in New York for presidents of corporations. There were 35 corporation presidents there. I was the 36th. And I was the only one of a religious corporation. Very interesting, trying to explain to them what the navigators are. I got a little kick out of Elaine Lanier. Don and Elaine and I were having dinner here, and the lady asked us what the navigators were. And twice, where's Elaine? I can't see her right. I want to see her. Oh, yes. She said, and so the lady, the waitress, was looking at Elaine, and she was trying to explain, and twice Elaine said, well, you'll help me, I need some help here. My kids will say to me, Dad, how do you explain what the navigators are? Do you have trouble doing that? Let's see. Chuck Unger, there's a job for you. Give us some ways that our kids can explain to their friends what the navigators are. I don't know. But I've been tipped off ahead of time that at the opening session, we had a huge round table. All 35 people could sit at this big table. Huge thing. And they ask you about your corporation, how many employees, how much money it's you spent a year, and what you did. So it came around to me, and I said that we sought to get young men and women to commit their lives to Jesus Christ and to help them become better followers of His and to find their most useful place in society. Well, I hardly had any coffee breaks free thereafter. It was really something. And then some would come up to me afterwards and they'd say, now tell us what it, again was this. And I'd say, well, we're in the disciple-making business. I tried that one out. And I'll tell you what, that didn't work. And oh, I tried various things. I said to one guy, I said, now, you know Billy Graham? I was going to say, well, we believe like he believes in. Oh, Billy Graham. He said, I sat right next to him on the platform down in our city, and, you know, he's a blankety-blank good preacher. He's a blankety-blank good preacher. What was the effect on this old boy, huh? And one fellow come up to me after the, during the, what do you call that? The, the pre-dinner hour, the cocktail hour. There's another name for it. Happy hour. That's Marina Downing said that the happy hour, like they have the military, is a lot of people who don't like each other standing around where they don't want to be saying things they don't mean. But this fellow came up to me and he said, I'd like to be part of your organization. No, he said, I'd like to be a navigator. And, of course, I know what he's trying to say. I want what you've got. And it was a great opportunity. Well, then I would try saying that some of them, I'd say, well, now we work with servicemen and college students. College student, boy, I'm glad somebody is. You know how that, didn't go off on that today. And then I go through this little routine. We try to get them to commit their lives to Christ. And I would say, if you'd like to peg us a little more closely. Oh, then I tried this one. I said, we're in the business of meeting people's spiritual needs. And you know that went across. Yeah. Of course, a lot of people are in that business. Then I would say, now our answer to their needs is the Christian answer. And if you'd like to peg us a little more closely, we are those who believe that Jesus Christ is who He claimed to be, the Son of God, and that the Bible is what it claims to be, the Word of God. And then I said, then we move on from there. Well, I soon found who wanted to talk farther or further and who didn't. Yeah, and a lot did. Well, what about pastors? How do you explain this to pastors? I usually go to Matthew 9. That just today, as it was in the day that Jesus was here, the harvest is plenteous, but the laborers are few. And immediately you get a response there around the world. That's right. The greatest single need in Christendom today is spiritually qualified laborers. Right, right, right. Well, we are in business to do something about that. Laborers. That communicates. However you communicate it, I don't know. But we say to navigators that the aim of the navigators is to help fulfill the Great Commission. And usually we slip across that like ice, like it isn't there, to the list, to the next part, which says, by making disciples and developing disciple makers in every nation. Week before last, Bill Bright asked us, who were meeting together, he says, what is your concept of the Great Commission? And so we were talking about it, and I shared some things with him. And he said, you know, I have asked people, and even Christian leaders around the country, of how they would state, in their words, the Great Commission. And he said, you'd be surprised what watered-down, weak-kneed answers I get. He said, we talk a lot about the Great Commission, but when I ask them, what do you think the Great Commission is saying? He said, I get very weak answers. Have you thought through for yourself, what really does the Great Commission say in its various forms in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, and Acts? You ought to know. Because that's our aim, is to help fulfill it. And how can you help fulfill it if you don't know what it is? We need a lot of thinking there. But that's the aim anyway. The aim of every navigator is to be a disciple and to make disciples. And the aim of the navigator organization is to help develop disciple makers in every nation of the world. Yeah, a minority. But you know, the right kind of people, a few of them, can make a great big difference. We've got that going for us. Well, a worthwhile prize. I personally am sold on it. It's men. It's laborers. It's disciples. It's disciple makers. However you put it there, it's people for whom Jesus Christ died. Worthwhile prize. Then he says, so run that you may obtain it. And I think the second requisite is that we get in the race to win it. Compete to win. To win. Well, if you read 19 through 23, just above this passage, and just underline each time the word win comes, that I might win the more, in order to win the Jews, that I might win those under the law, that I might win those outside the law. Win, win, win. Compete to win. A winning spirit. I've heard Billy Graham speak to pastors and talk to them. He said, look, every time you make a presentation, you ought to preach for a decision. So the reason a lot of you don't get results is you don't preach to a decision. I'd say there's a man who competes to win people. I heard him say one time to a small group of people that when he, oh yes, I know it was some of the team who wanted him to shorten his sermons. He said, well, I feel like I have to preach through them. I thought that was an interesting way to put it. Not just preach to them. He said, I feel like I have to preach through them. Like you're driving a nail all the way through and clinching it on the other side. Something relentless about it. compete to win. I told some of you about my brother, Leonard. Came to the Glen for the first time. Now, Leonard didn't commit his life to Christ till he was 35, and he's been going like a house of fire ever since to try to make up for lost time, apparently. So I was taking him around the Glen. I said, now, there's the pink house. We used to live in the pink house. It's got 6,600 square feet of floor space. I said, boy, Len, you got to see, it's a big place. Yeah, that is quite a house, isn't it? He said, you know, what do you do when you can't get a guy through the four verses of the B rations? So we're driving around, we talked about it, drove around. There's the castle. Got 67 rooms, all the bathrooms, you know, and the bedrooms, I told him, all the fireplaces. That is quite a place, isn't it? He said, you know, I've got a guy that I've been working with for 2 months to try to get him in a quiet time. Now, what do you do with a guy who says yes, but then doesn't do it? Well, he wasn't too interested in pink houses, castles, lawn, all the rest. I would say, and I happen to know, that that guy is in the battle. He is out to win. He is committed to it. He is concentrated on it. One time, I never forget, the Chattanooga Crusade. I was there in the counseling and follow-up department. Doss came to visit me. We took a little nap after lunch. I lay on one bed and he in the other. And before we went off to sleep, I said, Doss, you know, in all these big crusades and these thousands of counselors and all, it's sometimes kind of lose the, you can lose the vision for, you know, what we believe about the importance of one person and man to man and all. And he said, Sandy, I sometimes wonder if you have that vision. Well, you know, I may be ignorant, but I'm not stupid. I thought about that a good deal. He wanted to say, when you think about it morning, noon, and night, when you wake up in the morning, when you go to sleep at night, then that vision has you. And whatever else you would say about him, I would say that Doss Trotman competed to win. He was committed to it and concentrated on it. That's necessary if a small group's going to make a big impact. We can't be diluted, non-committed. We're going to make any impact. That's another message I've been working up while I've been here, and I won't get to bring it. This one thing I do, not these many things I dabble at, to figure out what is absolutely basic and work at that. And then commit myself to it. The third thing here, he says, every athlete exercises self-control. Proverbs 25:28 says that a man without self-control is like a city broken into and left without walls. It is defenseless. He is defenseless. And I don't know how it is with you, but it seems like there are always some battering rams around of circumstances or my own self or something constantly testing the walls of my life, trying to crumble them on one side or the other. Do you find that out? Do you find that? You're lashing out at the children, harsh with your wife, overindulgence in the table, too lazy to exercise, cut the quiet time short. Well, something always seems like there's a probe somewhere nudging at that wall to see if you can't crumble it. And the more I reflect on it, the more I realize that one of the most important things in life is control. You take these automobiles out in the parking lot, what powers them? Explosions power them. Controlled explosions. A lot of power there, but it's not useful unless it's controlled. Every athlete exercises self-control. And for self-control, I find, and I'm sure you find, that your strongest preaching has to be to yourself. I mean literally. Do you preach to yourself? I've got a daughter who walks around talking to herself. I kid her about it. But that's not too bad an idea. You remember the rich man that had all these grains, so he tore down his barns to build big ones? Remember what it says? This guy said, "And I will say to my soul," soul? He preached to himself. And what was his text? His text was, "You have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry." So he preached to himself to eat, drink, and be merry. And God said he was a fool. Over in Psalm 45, the psalmist says, "When my heart is disquieted, I will say to my soul, soul, why are you disquieted? Why are you cast down? Hope in God." Get a hold of yourself and preach to yourself. Our most powerful messages, our strongest urgings, need to be preached to ourselves. The other day, Ray Steadman came out to the Glen. He's the pastor from the coast and said, "Hey, what's your biggest battle in the Navigators these days?" I said, "Me." He says, "That is right, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, that's right. That's my biggest battle. Biggest fight you've got. Win that one, everything else comes easy." I was talking with the gals a little bit this morning about men, husbands, fathers, and how the Apostle Paul wrote to a group of people. As far as I understand, he had never met them, the Christians at Colossae. And in writing to them, he was going to give some instruction, some admonition to wives, to husbands, fathers. Now, if you were writing to a group of people you had never met, and you were going to pick out some kind of an admonition to give, you probably would pick out something that's universally applicable, wouldn't you? There is a common need for men. And it says here, "Husbands, love your wives, and do not be harsh with them." Apparently in that day, it's rather a common thing for a husband to, if he isn't careful, to be too harsh with his wife, severe. And that's continued right on down to this day. I was telling the gals this morning, I've got a house full of girls, a wife and three girls. And until the dog got hit by a car, we had, you know, a female dog in the house, just girls. And I'd come home and I'd feel, well, after all, I need a man around this house and her to growl a little bit, kind of shape things up. So I'd make one statement and I'd look around and everybody's in tears. My first reaction, well, what a bunch of sissies in his house. Or if it wasn't tears, it was like looking around and I'd, you know, look out the window. It looked like the San Francisco fog had settled in on over our, in our household. And every face was cloudy. What's the matter? I'd say to my wife later, I says, "What's with all this? I mean, why all the blubbering at the table?" I said, "Look, you can bark 5 times louder than I can and 5 times more often. And I just say one little sentence and everybody's in tears." And so she has to patiently explain to me the difference. I don't know about you, but I have to preach to myself and say, "Lauren, love your wife and don't be harsh with her. And fathers, don't provoke your children, lest they become discouraged, or as it puts another scripture with Phillips, don't overcorrect them, which is apparently another tendency that we men have. Or I'm meeting with Rod Sargent and Jim Downing and the guys in the afternoon in some committee meeting, and boy, we're getting the facts out. I mean, it's facts. See, facts, facts, facts. It's why. Let's get away from all the emotions, let's get on to facts. So you go home, you don't switch gears, and you start playing lawyer at the table. And it doesn't go over very well. You say, well, I want just facts. I mean, how do you know? Where'd you get that information? Well, don't play lawyer, you know, around here. I mean, just... And if I'd have spoken to you tonight on a heart for people, on faith, hope, and love, I'd have pointed out to you the tremendous need that people have for hope and how easily hope is dashed. How easily people can be discouraged. And how that life itself at school and the neighborhood and everything seems to come down upon us to discourage, right? People need to be constantly encouraged and built up and hope. You can, not you can't, you can't. And so I say, control, Sandy. Self-control. Your emotions. Your statements. Don't jump too quickly. Hold it. Wait a minute. Exercise self-control. And I find out, and I'm sure you do too, that when I'm all upset inside, and I get up in the morning, and even while I'm shaving, I'm mentally arguing with somebody. I say so-and-so, and in my mind they say so-and-so back, and then I say so-and-so, and they say so-and-so, and pretty soon I'm at a white heat, and there's nobody there but me. I'm usually wrong. And even if I'm right, it's certainly the wrong time to do anything about it with an attitude like that. Because why am I upset? If I'm right, why not relax and pray and give it a little time, and time and conscience are on our side. Good morning. Self-control. Is that an alarm clock? Let's stand up and stretch a minute, shall we? All we could say about self-control and its importance if we're to make any impact. But the fourth thing is make progress. Make progress. Well, said, I do not run aimlessly. I don't fight like one that beats the air. You know, your guy's running like everything. Where are you going? I don't know. Well, how do you know you're going to get there when you get there? You can't make any progress if you don't know where you're going. You have to have some goal, some objective, some aim. Then you can measure how you're doing. And when you box, it isn't how often you swing and miss. It's how often you connect. You've got to make progress. Dawson was fond of saying that emotion is no substitute for action, and action is no substitute for production. One of the hottest things going today in the church across America is what's happening down here at the Coral Ridge Presbyterian Church in Fort Lauderdale with Dr. James Kennedy. And pastors everywhere are flocking to hear what he has to say. He tells how he started down there with 40-some members fresh out of seminary, and the thing grew to 17. With his great messages. He accepted an evangelistic week over here in the South somewhere, just to kind of get away from there for a little bit. And the preacher there said, well, I know we got meetings at night, but we'll go out calling in the daytime for so. He said, we'll go out and do some evangelism. So this preacher took him out He said he was scared to death. But they did it morning and afternoon for 10 days. Well, he went back home all fired up for evangelism. He said, well, I think I mentioned this in the Dear Staff letter, how that that's where he got a class started. 6-week class. Got nobody saved as a result. Nobody out evangelizing. So he did a 10-week class. That didn't work, so he tried a 12-week class. So finally, he said it took him a little while, but it finally dawned on him to do with what was done with him. And so he took one fellow out. And pretty soon he had a soul winner. And now they got, a membership, 2,000, 2,500, four services on Sunday morning, starting with that little 17 he had left 10 years ago. The man that took him out, you know how he learned? He'd been taken out by some guy before that, one by one. But the irony is, a guy that took the pastor out, that took Kennedy out, later wrote Kennedy and asked if he could come down to his church and find out how he did it. Isn't that an irony? But my point is, you've got to make progress. Action is no substitute for production. All kinds of activity. And this is one of the things we're supposed to be majoring in. To help people who only have 1 hour a week, or a night a week, or 2 nights a week, how to make that time produce, right? Because people today across the country are sick and tired of activity. They want some productivity. If you're going to make any impact, we've got to make progress. And one thing that's necessary, of course, is some goals. I said in the next 10 years, we want to develop about 12 sending countries. Quadruple our staff. These 3 years, 70, 71, 72, we have a goal of 60 new area representatives on the staff. And as of December 31st, 1972, I want to have on my desk the names of 1,600 non-staff disciple makers who are active with us in the ministry. And during these 3 years, we should have made 8,000 disciples in the Navigators. So I'll tell you better, December 31st, 1972. How we did. Now, we could be the nicest gang that ever went out of business if we don't make some progress towards some specific goals in terms of results. And these are the results we're looking for. You got to make progress. Not just stir up dust. Not just make noise. Do something. My dad always liked to say that a noisy motor is hitched to no task. It's usually idling when it makes a lot of racket. But you hitch it to a task, it'll quiet down. So we're not looking for noise, we're looking for results. Light does not make much noise, as far as I know. But it's effective. Salt doesn't make noise, as far as I know, but it's effective. And Jesus said, you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. Now, the last thing we've got to do is endure. Just plain stick it out. One Christian leader said, I am convinced that maybe the big thing in the Christian life is just to last. I think he has something there. Someone else said that few end well. That is frighteningly true. But I pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. And the longer I'm around this thing, the more I realize We need not only need power to achieve, but we need strength to endure. God is my strength and power, and he makes my way perfect. 1:1, 2:2, 3:3, Samuel. He said, I pummel my body. I don't indulge the flesh. And this is something we fight all the time. We can indulge the flesh in such a way as to disqualify ourselves down the road a ways. Whether that's food or comfort or money or whatever. You can also indulge the spirit. As far as I can recall, I can't think of more than two or three people who disqualified themselves in the Navigators because of adultery. But there's quite a long list who have done so because of bitterness. There are more people on the shelf today, in my opinion, because of bitterness than any other one thing. And that bitterness came out of either a real or a supposed ill treatment. Looking diligently, lest any of you fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Hebrews 12:15. There have been people who have been mismanaged, have been mishandled in the Navigators, have been misjudged. And frankly, I think I'm one of them. I think there are times when Doss was absolutely 100% wrong as to fact, and he was wrong in taking me to task like he did. But as to heart, I always felt he did it because he loved me. And though he was wrong as to fact, I thought his intent was right. And even if he had a momentary lapse on intent, would it be worth it to let it eat up my insides and cannibalize my own self? I said to one guy once, I said, all right, let's assume that not only were you mistreated, but it's 100 times worse than you think it was. Is it still worth it eating you up and paralyzing your spiritual progress? It isn't, is it? Really? You see, the way it starts is you get under pressure, then you get frustrated, then you get resentful at the people or things that you think are frustrating you. And a lot of us, you know what this is all about. But then if that resentment begins to eat away, it turns into bitterness, like strychnine. You won't last. You'll come apart. It's like the termites eat away the inside. It looks okay on the outside until all of a sudden some pressure comes and it collapses. Now, gang, we'd like to be in the saddle right on down the end of the trail. In Psalm 92:14, they still bring forth fruit in old age. They are ever full of sap and green. And as the hair gets grayer and thinner and the wrinkles increase, I think that we can still bring forth fruit right on down to the end. We keep our hearts warm, forgiving spirit, endure. You know, it says, Jesus said, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. I thought one day, how does that come? The meek are those who are patient under injuries. Those who are impatient under injuries are the people who begin to eat up inside. And it contributes to a coronary. Contributes to a lot of things. And I decided that the reason that the meek inherit the earth, because they're the one that lasts the longest. Because an inheritance goes to the survivors.
I think there's a lot to that, though. Keep the attitude right, so we'll endure right on down to the end. That's why Jesus put such a big thing of forgiveness, a forgiving spirit. He made a big thing about forgiving spirit, didn't he? Well, some thoughts on how a small group can make a big impact. And the last point is just stick around longer, last longer, be at it longer. We want you around for a long time. Take care of yourself, will you? Inside and out. Let's pray.